So it's my great pleasure to welcome, for the first time, to Many Rivers Books and Tea, in the speaking chair, that is, Linda Sartor, the author of this book, Turning Fear into Power, One Woman's Journey Confronting the War on Terror. The title, I think, says a great deal of what sets the tone for what Linda will be talking about today. It's my great pleasure to welcome Linda to Many Rivers Books and Tea. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you. So I'm going to start with two examples of the kinds of things I ended up doing in various different countries after 9/11. Were citizen diplomacy and peacekeeping, unarmed civilian peacekeeping. So I'm going to start with a couple examples, and then I'll go more into introducing myself and the rest of the talk. But so an example of unarmed civilian peacekeeping was when I was in Sri Lanka. There had been a massacre that had taken place the night before, and those of us that were unarmed civilian peacekeepers with the nonviolent peace force came that morning. The people were really anxious to show us the bodies and to tell us the story that they had, that each of them had experienced the night before, and they recognized some of the people that had been involved in the massacre as Navy, Sri Lankan Navy. What has to happen in Sri Lanka is that the judge has to see the bodies before they can be taken care of. So while we were there talking to the people about what had happened the night before, the Alice, there's a chair over here. Welcome, thanks for coming. So while we were talking to the people, we saw this sort of parade, entourage of Navy guys, police, and the judge walking down the street. So the people of the village just immediately went into probably a terror. The women and children went into the churchyard across the street from where I was standing. The men kind of clustered on the street. And I put myself, and I stood out because I'm white, and all the people were brown. So I put myself on this side of the men, and the military parade was coming down this way. And everybody was tense. And I just stood there, and as they went by, I just smiled and waved. And it totally shifted the energy. It just completely changed the whole. And then in that moment, I knew in my body that I was safer because I wasn't carrying a weapon than I would have been if I had been carrying a weapon, because the weapon creates more fear. The fear creates more of a chance for violence, more of a likelihood for violence. So there's some situations where I know, in my body, I know unarmed civilian peacekeeping is more powerful than armed peacekeeping. The other example is of citizen diplomacy, and that's when you go to a country that's oftentimes portrayed as our enemy, and you have people to person-to-person relationships. You get to know people, and they get to know you. And so I was in a number of different places like this, but this story comes from Iraq. And I was there in the month before we started bombing in Iraq. We didn't know when we were going to start bombing. This particular team delegation, they only wanted to take people who had experience in war zones. I'd had my 2 weeks in Israel-Palestine, and that qualified me for being able to be on this team that went to Iraq just before the bombing started in February. We were there in February. And one of the people we met there was this hotel clerk at the hotel where we stayed. And the day that we were leaving, he came in, it was his day off, he came in to say goodbye to us. And this hand over the heart is a common greeting that people in Iraq and other countries use. It's like, even so, walking past somebody on the street, they would put their hand over their heart and nod. And shaking hands, they would put their hand over their heart and shake hands. It was just a greeting, and I just find it so so touching. And what he said, He says, I don't have a wife or child, but all of the earth community is my family. All of you are my brothers and sisters. If there is a war, if there is no war, it doesn't matter. I still have my smile. And I'm a pretty normal person, or pretty ordinary, not normal, maybe ordinary person. I teach graduates, part-time teaching at the graduate level. I guide wilderness trips where people are going to go out and do a three-day fast alone in the desert. Actually, that work has informed me in this process a lot. I'll talk a little bit more about that. I sing in the Love Choir in Sebastopol. I live in an intentional community over on the east side of Santa Rosa, between Calistoga, St. Helena, and Santa Rosa. And because I lead those vision quest experiences, the 3 days alone in the desert, I work with people a lot on their fears, because people come to have this deep experience, which they have while they're in the desert, but they usually have never spent that much time alone. And there's fears, especially like mountain lions and rattlesnakes. Those are life-threatening fears that people have when they come. And I actually, where I live, we have both. I have not ever gotten to see a mountain lion, but we do have them in our area, and I definitely have seen a lot of rattlesnakes. I've learned by living with them how to be safer around those animals, and so I share that with the people on my vision quests when I'm guiding, so that they can feel more comfortable about having their experience, so that they'll know how to take care of themselves. But to them, those are life-threatening fears. They are. They can learn to be more comfortable with that. So after 9/11, another thing that happens on these trips is that people get in touch with their hearts, what their heart is telling them. More, so they have easier access. Hopefully they go home with easier access to that than they had before. So often in our busy, busy lives, we are so distracted from what we're conditioned to believe is reality and what we're supposed to do. We miss out on what our heart, our individual essence, spirit, whatever you want to call it, is calling us to do. And they get a sense, they get more in touch with that by going into this experience. So by witnessing people do that, I've been more able to be more in touch with my heart's yearnings. And also I've learned by working with people and their fears, how to work with my own fears. So after 9/11, and the way that the U.S. responded to 9/11, my heart was tormented. And I had always been a peace activist and an educator. And so after 9/11, that wasn't enough anymore. I needed to be doing something more. And what I had a strong desire to do was really to say with my body that my life as a U.S. American citizen isn't any more precious than anyone else's life in the world. So when I heard about what the International Solidarity Movement was doing in Israel-Palestine, this inner voice just said, you've got to do this. And then, of course, I decided, after a little bit of working with myself, decided I was going to do it. And then it was relentless. It was like I had all kinds of reasons showed up to talk me out, to easily talk myself out of doing that. But this voice was like, no, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how scared you are. You've got to do this. And so I had to work with my own fears the way I'd worked with people and their fears. Mountain lions and rattlesnakes didn't look nearly as scary as going into a war zone alone. So anyway, that was the beginning of this decade that my book is talking about. 10 years of experiences first in Israel-Palestine, just for 2 weeks, but it was a big 2 weeks. And then Iraq again for just 2 weeks. And again, it was a big 2 weeks. I ended up going to Sri Lanka with the Nonviolent Peace Force as a job. And I was doing, it was a pilot project with this international NGO that's wanting to train civilian peacekeepers, unarmed civilian peacekeepers, to go into various places of violent conflict where just the presence of outsiders can change the dynamic. Like that story that took place in Sri Lanka was when I was with the Nonviolent Peace Force. The idea is that to change the dynamic such that local peace workers can do their work in their own way with less fear and thus less violence. So I was going and coming from Sri Lanka for 5 years, and I spent a full 2 years, within that 5 years, I spent two full years in Sri Lanka. After Sri Lanka, I went to Iran. That was in 2008, just before Obama got elected. And that was with Global Exchange, and that was specifically a citizen diplomacy trip. And then I went to Afghanistan, first in 2011. And then I actually got to go back again and spend a full month there. The first trip was just 2.5 weeks. And so then the 10 years after 9/11 was finished, I'd already started writing the book in 2008 when I came back from Sri Lanka. And I didn't really know how it was going to end. But when I went to Afghanistan, and that was 10 years, and I realized, the first thing that happened that the U.S. did that I remember was we bombed Afghanistan after 9/11. It was, and so going to Afghanistan was like, okay, coming full circle, 10 years, that's nice, so I'm going to end it here. And then in 2012, I was still working on the book, of course, I got a call, and I got called to go to Bahrain, where the Arab Spring Uprising had taken place the year before, and the government, the cruel monarchy, had been brutalizing the people who were standing up for their democratic rights, and the U.S. was supporting the government, and the human rights leader in Bahrain had asked Kathy Kelly and Medea Benjamin, two women who had been I'd been crossing paths with in these various locations over the years, to put together a delegation. So Kathy Kelly gave me a call, and within 2 weeks I was on my way to Bahrain to be there for the anniversary of their first uprising on February 14th in 2012. So I was going to be there for 2 weeks. I had gotten a ticket for 2 weeks, but we had to pretend like we were rich tourists to get into the country, because they were turning away anybody that looked like a journalist or a human rights activist. And so I went with a person I didn't know before in Washington D.C. and we went as if we were a rich couple going on vacation. We did get in, but we only lasted 4 days because we were standing with the people in their protests, and they were illegal protests. So I was deported. But so anyway, I couldn't not include a little bit about that experience in the book. Mm-hmm. So in the afterword, I wrote like 6 pages just about that 4 day experience. So that's included in here as well. I'm going to read little bits, and then I'm going to talk about, I'm going to try to have time to talk about like one story from each of the places that I was, where I visited. We'll see. I want to stop talking by 8:30 so that we can have some question answer discussion. But if I'm saying anything and you're confused, when I'm talking from inside here, I don't always know what missing pieces I haven't given. So please feel free to ask questions, clarification questions about what I'm saying if something is confusing or doesn't make sense. My intention for writing the book, through telling my story, I hope to inspire readers to get more in touch with their own inner wisdom and to follow their heart's longings, even when it's scary. And in the face of all the crises in the world, it's easy to get caught in a sense of hopelessness that there's nothing one individual can do to make any significant difference, and so do nothing. We need to find the courage to take the actions that our hearts are longing to take, even when the odds seem hopeless and overwhelming, and when we know we may not see the results within our lifetimes. So that was the articulated intention for the book. But what I've found from people who've already read the book giving me feedback, that it's been a lot of different things to a lot of different people. One guy said that he has read a lot of self-help books, and this is the best self-help book that he's ever written, and it was not even designed to be a self-help book. One guy told me he liked the political analysis, because each time I went to a country, I learned more about how we got into the relationship that we're now in with that country, or how that country got into the dilemma that it was in. And so that's in there, some of the learnings that aren't ones that would be in a history book, probably. And then for some, it's the possibility of unarmed civilian peacekeeping. And I want to talk a little bit about the spiritual thread in the book, especially because this store, seems like the books that are sold in the store are spiritual themed. In the process of guiding vision quest experiences, people find different ways of getting in touch with their own spirit within. And I have various ways of doing that, but I have a wise woman inside that I've known since I was like in my early 20s. And she's one of my spirit guides. And this is her words to me while I was trying to figure out how I wanted to respond to 9/11. She says, "It's hearts in collaboration that can change the world, can change the way things are, can do the healing job that needs to take place on the planet at this time, and then change the way humans relate to each other, to all beings, forever. Here is where you reach the unreachable star. Here is where you find that for which you've been longing." So there's a spiritual thread through the book also. I'd like to begin with a story about my experience in Israel-Palestine. And this was before I had any training in nonviolent civilian peacekeeping, but I think I did more of that work in Palestine in that 2 week, or actually in like a 4 day period, than I got to do in Sri Lanka, really, because of the particular experience that I had. I went there to meet up with the International Solidarity Movement, and back then in 2002, I still believe I had this probably false sense of security that because the U.S. supports a lot of what's going on in Israel-Palestine financially, that it would be really bad PR if an Israeli soldier hurt a U.S. American citizen. Now, that proved not to be true, because in a few years later, Rachel Corey, a lot of you know her story, was killed while she was there with the International Solidarity Movement, killed by a soldier. Anyway, but I didn't have that story. If I had that story, I probably wouldn't have been as bold as I was. But while we were there, the soldiers had gone into and raided Balata Camp. It's a refugee camp in Palestine. And what their orders were to do, two things. They were bashing holes in the walls of the houses. The houses all shared walls, in this neighborhood, all shared walls. So they bashed holes so that they were creating a passageway through the houses for soldiers to walk instead of walking down on the street where they were subject to snipers. And this was the orders that they'd been given. So we couldn't do anything about the fact that they were doing that, except we could do it. What we could do is remind the soldiers of the humanity of the Palestinians whose houses they were doing this to. And every soldier would respond differently. Some would start, I mean, I did see some be more careful, and then others didn't seem to make any difference. But the other thing that they were doing is searching. So they would not only bashing holes in houses, but some of the houses they had orders that they needed to search, and then they would just go through everything and leave everything in shambles. Before they did that, they had taken all the men in the village from ages 15 to 50. They'd basically arrested them, taken them out on the first day before we arrived. So all the men had already been removed from the village when we arrived. And some of them were released. They weren't all held, but they were told not to go back until given further notice. So they were living, they were basically staying in the mosque outside the Balata camp, outside the village. But so we were there, and we were interacting with the women and children. We were witnessing the bashing of the walls and in houses with people while their walls were being bashed, talking to the soldiers. And we were also escorting women and children to the clinic, because they were basically on curfew, not allowed out on the streets, and the only reason that they could get out was if they had a reason to go to the clinic, which was right there in the village. So we did a lot of escorting of people on the streets. And then after the first day, the men started coming and going, so they were, something, for some reason they were being allowed in, but they weren't allowed to stay. And so sometimes we would be asked to accompany some of the men that were walking on the street. This one day we were walking with these three men, and look, on every corner there was an armed soldier who would call them over and ask for their papers and look at their registration and then send them on. Except for at one point, the three men were told to stand up against the wall and with their hands up against the wall, and these two soldiers were guarding them basically by gunpoint. And then all the men that started to walk by at that point were told to go up against the wall. Now, a lot of times I didn't know exactly what was going on because I didn't understand the language, but that's what I saw happening. And Starhawk actually was my partner. A lot of you know Starhawk. Out there on the street, and she was standing on the side, and I was just standing right like in the middle. The men were lined up against the wall, the two armed soldiers were out here, and I was just standing in the middle and paying attention. Like anytime a soldier went close to do anything with one of the Palestinian men, I went close and just made it obvious I was watching. And the soldiers really didn't have any idea what to do with it. I don't think it was in their training what to do with these internationals that were just kind of hanging around, getting in the way. And then all of a sudden, there's this whole group of soldiers coming down the road, and they were just kind of all milling around in there, and the Palestinian men were up against the wall, and I got a call from some reporter in the U.S., and I was sitting there talking on my cell phone to this reporter in the U.S. while all of this was going on. When I put down the phone, one of the soldiers caught my eye, who spoke English, caught my eye and said, "Go home." And I just said, "No." And it was like he didn't know what to do with that. So then at some point some order came and they released almost all the men and took a few off with them. And Starhawk and I went back to the clinic where we were kind of hanging out, had been kind of centering ourselves. But the next chapter in the book is called Feeling More Alive Than Ever. So that's the third chapter. The first chapter is actually how I went through this whole process of deciding I had to go and I couldn't change my mind. Second chapter is about my experience in Israel-Palestine. The third chapter is sort of now what? And I was reflecting on that. I was realizing I was feeling more alive than ever at one moment. And I realized, because I had worried about, when I was planning to go to Israel-Palestine, I had worried about having to deal with post-traumatic stress, you know, because of what I might see. I think I was lucky that I didn't see any horrible violence, but I came back instead feeling like more alive than ever. And when I was reflecting on that, I was realizing, you know, all of my life I've been bombarded with violence, you know, violence just on the TV, even if you don't watch it. It's just there when the TV's on you. You're aware of it. And I, always being aware of violence, but never being able to do anything about it, was really disempowering and deadening. And what I realized is that just having that moment, that memory of that moment when I was standing in between the soldiers and the Palestinian men, getting in the way. It just felt so like there is something, you know, that I can do. And that felt really empowering and gave me some of my life back that I had lost over the years. The fourth chapter is Iraq. And I want to tell a story about my teammates. So I was there for 2 weeks. Some of my teammates stayed on through the bombing and didn't leave until they were asked to leave, because, and the reason that they were given was for their own safety. So this is a story of when the team leader from my team was actually leaving Iraq after I'd already been home for a month. They had to drive from Baghdad all the way to Jordan, to Amman. And so they had to go out on the highway, and there was the British and American bombing had been taking place. So they were driving, and there were three carloads of foreigners, mostly Americans, driving, and they realized they needed to spread out and go as fast as they could to try to avoid becoming collateral damage. This car that had Cliff in it, Cliff was the team leader for my team that went to Iraq, was in the back and had a blowout. Probably shrapnel. They don't even know whether it got bombed or it was shrapnel on the road or whatever. But they had a blowout. The car was totaled. They were left there, and the other two cars were far gone. And they didn't, and not very many other people were on the road. They didn't know how they were going to get out of that situation. An Iraqi, a local Iraqi came by, picked them up, took them to the closest town. This town had been bombed by British, American planes 3 days before. It destroyed even the children's hospital. Two children had been killed. The only medical facility left in the town was a 4-bed, 20 by 20 foot room and a doctor. And that's where this guy took the group of three Americans that were in that car that had the blowout. The doctor treated them. Cliff had to have like 13 stitches. The doctor apologized because he didn't have any anesthesia. Yeah. And he also apologized. He said, normally we would take you by ambulance to Jordan, but in these circumstances, we can't do that. Can you imagine in the U.S., if we'd been bombed, if a village had been bombed by foreigners, and then those same foreigners came into town, how we would be responding to them? And so then after the doctor treated them, they tried to pay him, and he wouldn't take any money. And I want to read to you what he said in response to that. He said, "We treat everyone in our clinic, Muslim, Christian, Iraqi, or American. We all are part of the same family, you know." That's my story about Iraq. That's one of my stories about Iraq, the one I wanted to tell you. Sri Lanka, I was there for over a period of 5 years. I spent 2 full years in those 5 years, a total of 2 full years in Sri Lanka, in the various different field sites that we had set up. This was the pilot project for the Nonviolent Peace Force. So it was the first the first project where we were trying to figure out how to bring this Gandhian vision of having trained peacekeepers from all over the world in places of violent conflict, and our presence can change the dynamics to open up the political space for local peacekeepers to do their work in their own way. And I'm going to go back to that glimpse that I gave you earlier after the massacre in the village of Alapiti. We ended up spending days there where we actually were doing 24-hour presence in that village. And because we were present there, the people felt safe. And it's just a little bit more of the same experience of how being without arms was really... I mean, so the people that were feeling safe when we were there as outsiders without arms, when they didn't feel safe, when the Navy, who was supposed to be providing their security, was there. So at one point we thought, okay, so they're feeling better, we can go off and do our work in other places. during the day and we'll come back in the evening. And that that day we took off and went back to our office and did work in other parts of the area. When we came back that evening, there was like this sense of relief. The people were so welcoming and happy to see us. But we also heard from the priest of the church that he really wanted somebody to stay all the time. So that next day, I actually stayed alone there while the rest of the team went off and did work and brought back supplies that we might need while we were staying there. And we ended up doing 24-hour presence for the people until the situation got to the point where they ended up evacuating. But it was just a strong example of how just providing presence, just accompaniment, can make a difference for security, and how you don't need a gun to provide security. Moving on to Iran, I want to tell the story of Hussein Nuri, who is an artist, and we met him in the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tehran. He was quadriplegic. He painted using his teeth, holding a paintbrush in his teeth. He and his wife were there in the museum, and they came up and introduced themselves to us, and he told us a little bit of his story, and later I found online more of his story. He had been injured and became paraplegic from an injury caused by the Savak, and that's the secret police of the Iranian secret police that was trained by the U.S. during the times of the Shah. He was injured by them because he had produced a play in his high school about human rights. Two of his brothers had been killed as martyrs in the Iran-Iraq war, which the U.S. and Britain had a lot to do with, and are really the only ones who benefited, because they benefited from selling arms. And he told us the story of how he had painted this picture, this rendition of Mother Mary. I don't know if you can see it. I can pass it around. In response to this this Danish political cartoon, I don't know if you remember. This would have been in like... Yeah, okay. Many of you remember this really horrifying Danish political cartoon that was real derogatory towards Muslims. And so in Iran, there was a demonstration at the Danish embassy, and he went to the statement to the demonstration and was working on this painting, which he ended up gifting to the Danish government. And because he was taking a stand that all people, no matter what religious belief, deserve to be respected. And so, he had many, many good reasons to hate U.S. Americans. Yet, he and his wife both sent a message with us back to the U.S. They said, they asked us to tell the people in the U.S. that they love us. And then finally, my first trip to Afghanistan was to meet the Afghan peace volunteers. At that time, they called themselves the Afghan youth peace volunteers because they were all under 20. Gandhian follower from Singapore, a doctor actually, he had done his internship in Afghanistan in a refugee camp on the border, and fallen in love with the Afghan people and ended up staying. And so he was not practicing physician, but he was he had a commitment to bring up a generation of Afghan youth who understood Gandhi's nonviolence. And Kathy Kelly, who I'd met first in Iraq, had met Hakim, the doctor from Singapore, and was starting a relationship with him, with he and the Afghan peace volunteers. And so this was so I got invited to join this delegation to support them. They were coming from Bamiyan, which is like a 9-hour drive from Kabul, and doing various demonstrations for peace on the streets in places in Kabul. And so they invited these internationals to come witness, support, and participate in those demonstrations. So I got to know the Afghan peace volunteers, who are a group of young people who, you know, live in the horrible conditions that they've been brought up in Afghanistan, and which could be really hopeless, really a discouraging place to live. And they hold a hope for the future and for nonviolent ways to bring nonviolence to Afghanistan, and they don't even necessarily expect to see the results in their own lifetime, but yet they still have this commitment. And so it's a wonderful group of young people, group of people to know, and it's through them that I've gotten to learn a lot about what it's like in Afghanistan. One interesting scene in that first trip was when we were there with the Afghan peace volunteers and the delegation of people from the U.S. and other countries. Australia was also there. And then some of the adults, the adult Afghans living in Kabul, who primarily were in favor of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. They actually remember the times, both the times after the Soviets left, when there was horrible fighting between among the tribes, between the warlords of the tribes, lots of brutality, and then out of that fighting, the Taliban really emerged out of that. And then under the rule of, and at first there was hope when there was a different government taking power. Because life was so brutal, it was even worse under the Taliban for the people. And so when the U.S. came in, they were actually feeling like there was, that in Kabul, that life was coming back to some sense of normalcy. So here we were in this room where there's the adults that are really in favor of the U.S. presence, the Afghan peace volunteers who are standing for nonviolence, and this delegation from the U.S. who are supporting the Afghan peace volunteers and wanting withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. So the Afghans were expressing opinions in favor of the U.S. and the U.S. People that were there were expressing opinions against what we were doing there. It was really an interesting situation. And one other thing I was noticing is that youth, women, and men were all being heard, being listened to and heard in that conversation respectfully, which was just a great experience to witness. So, by the end of the book, there's this afterword, and I talked to you about, or afterthoughts, and I talked to you about how I included Bahrain in that part. I also reflected overall on my journey and picked out a few themes that I thought might be helpful to readers. And the themes included spiritual practices, particular attitudes, and some strategies. And I talk about how many people have different spiritual practices, and any of them are helpful in doing this kind of work. For me, it was the Vision Quest experience and spending time in nature, spending time alone. For me, free writing is a way of accessing some of that inner knowing that I otherwise don't have access to. And the guided visualization, shamanic journeying, where I would get better in touch with those inner voices, the inner guides. I talk about the importance of trust. The final attitude that seems essential is trust. I have to trust the inner knowing or guidance. I have to trust myself to be able to handle whatever situations arise as I follow through on the guidance I have received. I have to trust the organization and the people whom I have joined in the endeavor. And in the end, I have to trust that someone in the world is a little better off due to my activity, even when it isn't obvious that it has made a difference. And the last thing I want to do, and there are some parts in this book where I've quoted other people, and this is, I want to leave you with this inspiring quote, thought from Clarissa Pinkola Estes. She said, and this came to me on an email, ours is not the task of fixing the entire world all at once, but of stretching out to mend the parts of the world, the part of the world that is within our reach. Any small, calm thing that one soul can do to help another soul, to assist some portion of this poor, suffering world, will help immensely. It's not given to us to know which acts or by whom will cause the critical mass to tip toward an enduring good. What is needed for dramatic change is an accumulation of acts, adding to, adding more, continuing. We know that it does not take everyone on earth to bring justice and peace, but only a small determined group who will not give up during the first, second, or hundredth gale. So. So, now we can have discussion or questions and answers. Anybody have any reflections or thoughts or questions?
I have one. I think it's really encouraging for me. I'm just embarking on my peacekeeping career, or I'd like to think of it as a journey more than a career, but one of the closing remarks you made is that it's very often those movements and those efforts you make that aren't very obvious and aren't recognized. And I think that a lot of people who make peacekeeping efforts, that's where they receive the most rewarding results. You know, I mean, there are many moments where you question, maybe you've wasted this whole time, you know, following a certain path and a voice inside. It's also really great to hear that you talk about these voices and these thoughts in your head that go on, because this really is a spiritual journey. I think for most people who want peace, whether you get a master's in it, or maybe you had a career, I don't know, as a therapist or a doctor, and you decide to follow another path, that there is a spiritual journey that goes on with that. And you know, now I realize, well, why wouldn't there be? This is about the human condition. This is about humanity. And conflict resolution is often a beautiful thing, because it forces us to contend with the humanness of ourselves. It reveals our greatest fears. It reveals the things that are non-negotiable to us. And sometimes we discover those by looking at other people, what's non-negotiable to them, what makes them most vulnerable. Thank you for that. That makes me feel like I'm not alone on this kind of conundrum between those voices and my desires to make a difference.
And thank you so much for who you are and what you're embarking upon.
Thank you.
You speak very, very deeply and articulately.
Thank you.
It's great to meet you.
Likewise.
Okay. Going to all these different places and knowing our foreign policy isn't the best, is people still seem to like America despite the harm that we do to them. Why is that? What do
you know? One interpretation I have is that many of these people live in places where they know government doesn't represent the people. So they say over and over again in Palestine, as soon as they knew where we stood about President Bush, it was like, we love Americans, we don't like your government, you know? I think we still have this illusion that our government represents us.
No.
Or something. I mean, because I don't think it's as easy for us to see that governments aren't the people. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the only, because it's very true. Every one of these countries where I've been, now in Afghanistan, many Afghans did not like foreigners, period. They've had too much foreigners trying to take over, and they just feel like they want to be left alone to work it out for themselves, even if they have to do it violently.
But no, they know it's about their resources or don't know about it.
Well, I think there's so much complexity but the people. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'll be in touch.
Okay, great. The people were all in all of these places were really warm, hospitable, and friendly, and loved Americans. Yeah. I wouldn't say all of the people did, but at least the ones that we were interacting with. Because, again, everybody, there's, you know, many different people with many different perspectives in any one situation.
I'm so when I heard you, when I heard the whole thing and what happened in Palestine with you just standing there, that one person standing there saying, "No, I'm not leaving," you know, and I'm like going, "Oh my God," you know, "Oh my God," and I just kind of like wanted there to be a thousand of us, you know. It's like, why isn't there? Why is? How can we make it so that there's more? It's more. And bigger, because then it seems like that would tip the whole experience a little bit, or maybe not. I mean, I don't know. Maybe a thousand would be too intimidating.
Well, so you're shaking your head. What do you have to say to respond to that?
The ships are trying to go into Gaza with medical everything.
Right.
You get turned. You cannot go against Israel. End of subject. The history of the state of Israel, and it's coming out, and no one's giving up. And I think this last excursion of theirs has really turned the world against them.
But there's so much money coming in from the United States to Israel.
Yeah, that's what the only place that I think we can make a difference is by changing that. And ever since 2002 when I was there, you know, I have these images in the back of my mind. I get emails telling me how it's continuing to be that this way in Palestine.
Right.
The abuses continue, and I can't see, other than the people that already believe what I believe, I can't see how we can change things in the U.S. because the powers in place seem so in place. You know, it's like so when this last thing happened and there was more dialogue right in my own community, I was like, you know, while people were upset, I was relieved because finally we're talking about it.
Right.
But still, you know, and that's one of the things I think I've learned for myself is just being with whatever it is. Like torture is one that just has me. The torturing that we're doing, the U.S. is doing in the world, has me really upset in the same way, that hopeless, helpless kind of place. And all I can do so far is just not go into denial about it. Just keep that consciousness present and then do whatever is in front of me to do to bring that little bit of peace, justice. Because, you know, it can't just be peace. We've had a lot of peace without justice.
Right.
And a lot of that is true in Israel, Palestine, in the U.S., in various places. So it's keep the intention for justice present while I'm staying present to what is, and then trying to find what my heart is telling me to do with that. You know, but if I go into denial about it, then I go back into that place of not feeling alive, you know, letting parts of myself die because it's because of the denial. Because you can't just deny parts
reality.
Of your life, yeah, parts of reality without denying some, you know, other parts of
there's
your
also like bombing, the bombing that's going on now in Iraq, right?
It's right, but you know what? In
Syria.
Yeah. And and the thing is, another thing that's happened is complexity of my thinking. You know, it's like it's not sure I am. I'm committed to nonviolent solutions, and I'm committed to justice, and they don't always work well together. And like when one of the people I met in Palestine was a man who had been he was a nurse in a in an ambulance that had been bombed by napalm, and he had burns almost all over his skin. He had just been released from the hospital. He was covered with bandages, and he was in a place in Palestine where there was curfew at night. So he couldn't go out at night. He couldn't go out during the daytime because of the he couldn't expose his skin to the sun. So he was in essence imprisoned in his home, and we were interviewing him. His brother spoke after he spoke, and his brother said, "You know," and he talked about how Palestinians are loving people, and he said, "But after I've seen what has happened to my brother, I can understand suicide bombing." Mm-hmm. And not that he condoned it, and that's the way I am. It's like when there's injustice and you're not being heard any other way, right, you can understand, or so I can understand why there is violence in some situations. So being with that knowledge of, I want nonviolence, I want nonviolent solutions, this is happening, it's totally unjust, where do we go from here? But it's, to me, it's really important not to go to sleep, mm-hmm, and not to go into denial. And it's really easy to get busy with the rest of our lives and to forget about the stuff that is happening in our name with our, you know, with our taxpayer money. So,
and I think your book is so important because it you actually went there. You have a story instead of, and because we're so screened out from what is really going on, because there's no journalists that are allowed in, there's no truth
saying. Yeah, and I just get glimpses. Yeah.
Not for YouTube.
Yeah, there's some hope with the internet, huh?
I've been studying the situation in Israel and Palestine since high school, and it's really not that complicated. And basically, you've got some very...
Can everybody hear?
I just say, I've been studying this since high school, and it's really not that complicated. And it's basically comes down to about 16 families in Israel. And this was reiterated on Amy Goodman's just last week. A young soldier said that he realized that while he was patrolling the Palestinian areas, that he was just basically doing the work of a few wealthy Israelis. And the same in this country, and why it's been silent, because arms dealers and arm manufacturers in this country make billions of dollars every year with their contracts with Israel. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically like Smedley Butler said in his War is a Racket. It always boils down to the profits of war. And that's what you're dealing with. In the and I'm not saying there aren't some idealistic Jews that are, you know, want to return to the homeland and all, but not most of the, what is it, Madagascar was offered to the European Jews at the end of the Second World War. If they wanted to have a homeland that didn't already have people living there, that they were given an opportunity to start a homeland in Madagascar, but they, when they wanted to go boom right into it, the homes that were taken away from the Palestinians, these wealthy Israeli families made money, a fortune on real estate, selling those properties to the incoming Jews from war-torn Europe. And it's not hard to understand, but the perpetuation of it keeps a lot of people making so big money in the process.
Right.
You're getting all mad.
This is a passion of mine right now.
Okay. Well, she's got a little map, but when you say it's not that difficult,
if it wasn't that difficult, we'd have peace in the Middle East. The Israelis went in and took over Palestinian land.
Right.
Everyone knows that truth, except the Israelis. They don't want to know it. They live in denial.
Well, a lot of Americans do.
Correct. But there was a game plan put in place in the 80s. By Oded Wayon, Odedyion, and it basically was about a greater Israel, but it goes even back to the Rothschilds.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, Rothschilds.
You know, it's all about who controls money, who controls the media, etc. Mm-hmm. This is about a greater Israel, and Wesley Clark admitted it shortly after 9/11 that Bush's plan, with his neocon Israeli firsters working in his administration, had a game plan to break up Syria, Libya, Egypt, to break it all up for greater Israel. Mm-hmm. It's been written, it's mm-hmm. known about, but we can't talk about it in the media. But as soon as this last excursion of theirs hit the TV screen and everybody was in an uproar, quickly, boom, it's off the news.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
It never happened.
Because it's like a big
It will never stop until Israel totally controls the Middle East, period. Sorry.
From
the boycott of 1933 with Hitler, everything is a historical lie and cover-up. It's just getting exposed now. Lots of people have to die in the
process. Rothschild financed Hitler's.
Mm-hmm.
Can we get back to her book?
It touches on a lot. It stirs up a lot.
One little bit coming in. I don't know if you addressed what your thoughts were on why we're in Afghanistan. Is it like a puppy grab or arms again?
Oh, I think the U.S. Well, even the people in Afghanistan that were arguing for us to say no, that the U.S. is there for its own interest. And actually, they recognize that that's what governments are supposed to do. They're supposed to be doing stuff in the world for their own interests. But they were feeling like our interests were in alignment with their interests, and that's why they wanted us to stay there. But yeah, I'm sure it's for our own interests, and there's a number of different things. But
oil,
yes, and I don't remember.
Minerals?
No, there was a pipeline that was going to be going through Afghanistan, connecting.
The English and the
that
Russians.
That could be one of
the
reasons, yeah.
So, what would you do next if you had a choice of going back to any of these countries or.
Well, you know,
it's
interesting because when I don't always know, you know, like a lot of it, like both the first trip to Afghanistan, I only knew like 3 weeks before. I think that was the one where I had to get my ticket before I even got my visa. Mm-hmm. And Bahrain was only 2 weeks. And I haven't been called to go someplace when I was able. See, and the thing is that because of my life, because I teach graduate level, but I teach mostly online, I can be anywhere in the world and still doing that job. So as long as I don't have a wilderness trip scheduled, you know, like when something comes up, I just look on my calendar and it's like, okay, I can do this, you know. And if right now I'm in the process, I know I'm going to be moving from my house in my intentional community to a different house. I don't know exactly when that's going to happen. So I couldn't go anywhere this fall because when it's time for me to move, I need to move. But now it really seems like what I'm being called to do, which is almost more difficult than going to these countries, is promoting this book. But and you know, and it's
and
interesting because
like
all of my friends are helping me do it because people see it, read it, and they know this message needs to get out, so that's making it a lot easier. But I stressed. This was my first public book talk. I stressed over it for the last 2 weeks, and today all day. It's just not me, not the me that I know from my experience of me. Exactly. It wasn't me to go alone into a war zone either. You know, it's like this is my heart knows differently than what I think, what my mind thinks I know about myself.
Professor, aren't you used to lecturing and teaching?
No, I don't lecture at all. And then, you know, even I was doing presentations after Iran and Afghanistan, but they were slide presentations, so everybody's attention was on the slides. Okay. No, I'm not a lecturer. I work in discussion and groups, small groups, you know, it's just, I'm not a lecturer.
Well, you've done a great job.
Thank you.
So I have one question in your book about, you did explicit details about some of the American soldiers, the torture part, the really, really gnarly stuff, and I couldn't figure out why the American soldiers were torturing the people from Sri Lanka. I didn't understand.
No, I think that actually was when I was in Sri Lanka, but I had gotten a message from Iraq. It was about Iraq.
Oh, okay.
Iraqians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa.
Yeah. But that's actually my biggest fear. I don't have so much fear of dying. In fact, I'd rather die than be tortured.
Yeah.
Or abducted and tortured. Yeah. So that's my biggest fear. And I haven't really... I haven't really gotten to any good place with that fear yet, except that I'm aware of it. And more aware of it, the more I hear about the U.S. torturing others. You know.
Yeah. And I learned from the Bennett.
I heard that Teddy Roosevelt had a pill that he was going to swallow in the jungles of South America.
He had
a hard time getting out of that situation with his son.
Uh-huh.
He managed to.
That's a good idea. I have to look into that.
Like a James Bond pill.
You know Catherine Yates? She's a neighbor of mine. She wrote a book called Bombs, Baklava, Bombs, Bagels, and Baklava.
Uh-huh.
About her time going to the University of Palestine, and she met Yasser Arafat. And she wrote this probably about 15 years ago.
Yeah, because Arafat was still in power when I was there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it hasn't been that long. And have you ever... You know, I think as a group we ought to just send our love next time you're in the Middle East. Tell them how much we love them.
Yeah. And one thing I want to let people know about is I have a Yahoo listserv. If you want to, I wish I had something to write on that I could post. If you want, yeah, that'd be great. I'm going to give you my email address. So if you would like to be invited to be on that list, so that if I am in another country, you'll hear from me, and you'll hear little bits from me. Like when I got that Clarissa Estes quote, I sent that to my list. I like to keep people, when I find something inspiring, I like to send that. But I also, when I'm in another country, I frequently, send little glimpses of my experience for two reasons: to give you a sense of what's happening, but also to reassure you that I'm okay. But so if you'd like to be on that list, I'm going to post my email address.
Putting it on the counter.
Oh, okay.
So people can sign up.
Oh, so write your email address really neatly so I can read it, and then I have to send you an invitation, and you have to respond to the invitation in order to get on the list.
So I know you're on the board of the Peace and Justice Center, and you know what, I'd like to hear what you have to say about violence right here in River City.
Yeah, well, you're talking about Andy Lopez.
Yes, well, it's one of many.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I got into a funk recently when I learned after Ferguson and Lopez, mm-hmm. when I learned about Urban Shield, which is the militarization of the police basically, and it's centered in Oakland. For 9 years, there's been this convention conference, and people from all over the world come and they compete in SWAT teams, and there's displays of weapons, and it's all about militarization of police. And they showed in 2012, one of their promotional YouTubes showed a scene of police confronting Occupy, and they portrayed Occupy as terrorists. And when I saw that, and I realized, okay, so I'm being seen as a terrorist. You know, I started even thinking about, well, you know, the whole idea of freedom to bear arms. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in countries where the only people who have arms is the government. Mm-hmm. And our Bill of Rights about freedom to bear arms was about so that wouldn't happen in the U.S. I got really discouraged at that moment when I learned about Urban Shield. And it's funded by the Department of Homeland Security.
And
this community, our community, our police and sheriffs are involved in it. They all
our
get
taxes.
Involved because, our taxes that pay the Homeland Security. Right. But the local communities that need to be doing emergency preparedness this is how they're meeting that requirement, and they have to be addressing terrorism, the war on terror, in this process, and not looking at floods, fires, and earthquakes. But so where did I go with that? That's one of the things I'm being with right now.
These people in those departments have all been sent on special junkets to Israel for counterterrorism training.
Right. Yeah. And then we did a good job of training the Savak, my friend who's saying what they did. So it's a big thing to be up against. And I don't think it's worthwhile to be against things. I think it's better to try to figure out what we want to create and figure out ways to create it. So any way that we don't support the
military-industrial
complex, you know, and multinational organization, corporation.
Military-industrial security.
Probably
everybody here knows this, but the Jewish folks I know in Sonoma County are very pro-Palestine. They are not happy with what the Israelis are up to.
There's quite a difference.
It's all
mixed.
I had a rabbi call me a devil.
So the more we can grow our own, the more we can localize the economy, you know, all of the bringing stuff back home, taking care of each other, building relationships with people, all the people that are in our lives, and confronting, the things that are happening locally. Join the Peace and Justice Center. we're embarking on a new project called the Freedom for Militarization, which includes militarization of police, but also militarization of the world, and wearing, camo, how much it's become part of our culture, militarization. It's all of that, freedom from all of that.
Where the militarization coming from and all that kind of stuff.
But
one of the things that I did a little bit of the activate the community, I did it was called World Reliance Cafe at the Grange last week, and it was all these little tables and brainstorming about how to build community and all that kind of stuff.
That's so great. How come I didn't hear about it?
Well, it was interesting. I only got it at the very, very tail end, was not involved with it at all. And there was a lot of young people in Sebastopol that were involved with it. Hardly ever anybody my age was there. It was maybe three or four people my age. But one of the things that I sat at a table and they said, well, how do you build reliance in your community? And I was, had some ideas, and people had some other ideas, and I said, and Roseland is 7 miles away. Mm-hmm. Why is that not our community?
Mm-hmm.
Why is Santa Rosa not our community? Why is it Sebastopol, building Sebastopol?
Mm-hmm.
Sebastopol.
Well, that's why I didn't hear about it, because I'm not Sebastopol.
Right, right. So, and that just kind of went over. They didn't want to even talk about that is our community. I mean, what happened to Andy Lopez is our community.
Yeah.
And if it's not in our backyard, then it doesn't it's not happening. The whole thing with the young man that got shot by calling 911. I knew his family. It's like that is our.
That's your community.
That's
yeah.
my community. And yet there was not even candles at the. At the police, it's like we didn't even acknowledge that it happened.
Yeah, and what I just realized when we're in this discussion, that sometimes we run into these things that seem so hopeless. I realized that I've been talking from my head again, and that it's what I really trust, and the head doesn't always understand what the heart is telling us to do, but I just really... that's the point that I want people to get out of reading my book, one of the points, is how important it is to follow your heart, and even if you're afraid. It's not like getting rid of fear. You can't deny fear. You can't get rid of it, but you can be with it and not let it stop you from doing what your heart's telling you to do. And you might not understand what your heart is telling you to do. But I think that so much of what we've been trying to do is what we think. and from our head, and if we could think more from our heart, we might find some solutions that aren't as obvious or as easy to figure out.
I also discovered that the heart, I read something in the Tao Te Ching about the still deep pool that is the heart, and I said, I wanted to keep the heart soft and open and receptive. And then what's you know, the chakra that's below that is the solar plexus, and it, you know, it exudes energy, and it exudes, and then below that one is the creative chakra, which is comes up with solutions and ideas, and then below that one is the rooting chakra, the first chakra that roots it in, and so instead of putting it into the heart, I utilize the other lower three chakras, and they come up with grounding and solutions and more energy and power, and so I just let the heart stay open and soft and receptive, and the mind just kind of receives it, and then kind of just to send it down, and oftentimes the grounding calms things, and the solutions, you know, can come up with creative ideas. And then the solar plexus says, I'm up for the job. And then the heart can just stay open and
what a great practice. So there's a spiritual practice.
I have one liner. I just saw this great bumper sticker yesterday. It said, don't believe everything you think.
Yeah. Yeah. I have another bumper sticker. It says, what is it? It's a bear arms. It says, I believe in arming bears. Oh. You can see that in Colorado.
But getting back to the question about our community is what I hear you saying, you know, follow your heart, but I also think that we need to stay awake to the trance that we are in, that it's not happening if it's not if we don't see if it's not in our community, it's not happening. And the whole thing with the military is really, really important to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's also the way of thinking that it's all happening inside as well. So
inside,
that
yeah.
Where's
the conflict?
Yeah, where is the Iraq in me, or where is the Andy Lopez situation in me? And I
think that if we get rid of the we and they a little bit, to move in the direction that we're calling to, you know, so you're talking about community over here. We're not a community as long as the police is they, or the military is they,
yeah.
Everybody else is they, because we're all one.
Yeah. Hmm. Rob.
I think one of the solutions is the younger generation. Mm-hmm. They are so different. They're much more in their heart than our older generations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going to save the planet and change the world.
Yeah, the more I meet some of the young folks, the more hope they have. Yeah.
Much more aware.
Yeah. Just like the young woman that was here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah, like I went to three different ones of the village building convergence that you were speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to the one you were talking about. But I was totally shocked when I walked in and everybody was 20 years younger than me, you know. It was just so great.
Yeah, it was great.
And they were really working hard at making something happen for the community and with the community. And a lot of the young people there were saying, oh, I've been a nomad for 5 years and suddenly I found Sebastopol and this community and I really want to work here and put down my roots. And so it just felt, hopeful, very hopeful.
Yeah, and the whole center is the Grange. I mean, they kind of bring in it from a whole, it's a very, very right-wing organization.
The Granges,
in
general.
In general.
But not
they
there.
Have taken, the Sebastopol has taken it over and has made it totally...
Sebastopol.
Sebastopol.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, Shepherd Bliss and the Occidental Center for the Art, I mean, OAAC, and people like that have have taken over the Greens for
225 members, and they're all left.
Kathy, did you have something more?
Well, just saying, the police. I've don't have many interactions with the police, but it used to be that they would kind of look at you in the eye, person to person. And I parked in a shady area, and waiting for my son's plane to land in Oakland in a little park, and I was supposedly blocking a fire. Mm-hmm. But the policeman came up to me, and he had all of this stuff on.
Yeah, I know.
And,
yeah.
And it was, he's much bigger than me, much better mm-hmm. armed. All I had was a little 10-pound dog. And the... there was fear in his eyes.
Uh-huh.
I could see fear.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sitting there trying to break through the fear and smile and be, you know, and all. And but you know, so I kind of made a point of trying to run into police, not to get a ticket or anything, but just to get any chance just to kind of make eye contact.
To try to make
a
connection.
But there is. Yeah, I remember police. You know, were not so. You know, they were.
With civil disobedience, I always like to get in relationship with the person who was arresting me. And with Occupy, so when I learned about that YouTube advertisement for this
Shield.
Yeah, Urban Shield convention, it was like it all clicked into place. Like, why I wasn't able to get into relationship with the police when they were behind their riot year here in Santa Rosa, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, during the Andy Lopez marches,
right?
And I tried to interact, and they it was them and I, you know, you just
yeah,
got a sense that. And I tried to bring 9/11 information to some firehouses. There was going to be a big talk about firefighters for 9/11 truth, and this young firefighter was like, really, what do you got there? And the older firefighter yanks him back and told me they didn't want to have any, you know, here,
mm-hmm.
take the materials I was handing out. Mm-hmm. And so it's it seemed to me in that case they were kind of being trained
uh-huh.
in how to respond to
yeah.
the problem.
Regarding Occupy, I just moved up here a couple years ago, and when I got involved with the Occupy, and because of how they suppressed everything. And I know you have meetings on Mondays, but are you not going to do any actions, street actions at all?
I know I haven't been going to the Occupy.
Okay.
So I think that the meeting on Monday is the homeless, Dorothy
yeah.
Day, and they're focusing on homeless issues. And there's good things happening in Sonoma County
mm-hmm.
for the homeless people.
But they don't do street actions anymore.
Not that I've been aware of, yeah, yeah.
Sunday, there was climate action.
Oh, yeah, yeah, not Occupy specific,
but
yeah, there's all kinds
action.
Of action still,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
there's a global chemtrail thing going on globally this weekend, too.
Mm. What does that mean?
For the chemtrails, with the climate change, but there's a global movement. So I think last year was their first one, it was in Australia. If you go online and check it out.
I think we're winding down, so I think there's one more thing.
The first is to thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you.